is Dr. Brian Walker, who is a member of the Legislative Council in the Parliament of Western Australia for the Legalised Cannabis Party. He has practiced medicine for many years in many different countries before finally settling into practice as a GP at Serpentine Medical Centre. He has frontline experience treating patients in hospital, emergency departments and general practice. If you are familiar with the book Dying to Be Me, which detailed the near-death experience by Anita Morjani, it should be noted that Dr. Walker was Anita's GP back in Hong Kong. She met up with him in the US 3 years ago and did a beautiful interview, which is available on YouTube. So let's together welcome Dr. Walker as he talks about how to remain calm during times of political madness such as these times.
I think it is. You can all hear me. What a wonderful way to start a talk. Listen to Ajahn Brahm guiding us in meditation. Very peaceful. It's very different to what I experience in my daily life. I've just come from a clinic where a lot of tragedy was happening, a lot of beautiful things too. People who are dying, people who are frightened of dying, people who are angry. And that all comes towards me. And so I can take this, I can absorb it, or I can let it go. And then I have my life as a politician, coming into the upper house as the leader of the cannabis party, the legalized cannabis party. And of course, everyone thinks, oh, that's a naughty man, a nasty man, a drug-taking man. And I'm a simple doctor. I'm there for wellness, for health. And to be treated as someone who is disrespectable, and then to find that people are beginning to respect when you speak and you bring forth information. It's strange. And then you sit in the chamber, and there's more crisis going on here. Yesterday in the chamber, there was shouting, people shouting at each other, people disrespecting each other, people saying naughty things and nasty things. And you sit there and you wonder, what's this all about? Because as a politician, I have sworn to serve the people of Western Australia. Do I serve people by shouting? Do I serve people by hating others? Now, it must be said, the politicians are playing games. There's no real hate in the chamber. It's basically a show. But you may see that as stupid behavior, question time in federal parliament. Is it real? Is it real? And then you listen to the news when you're driving to work and you hear China and Taiwan. And you hear how America has perhaps provoked this, or have they? And China has responded badly, or have they? You listen to Russia and Ukraine, the war going on there. Now, I've lived in China, I've lived in Russia. And you know these people, you know these places. And here they are, not just fighting each other and killing, children dying, using food as a weapon to starve other people, or waiting for the cold to make people freeze with no warmth, no gas. And you look at the climate emergency, the fires in Europe, the lakes going dry, the crops failing, as we continue to poison the atmosphere. And we can see crisis coming upon us, and we, the politicians, must do something. And there's pollution, talking yesterday about how all of us have microplastics in our bodies, and we, the politicians, must do something or we will die horrible deaths. Or looking at the US with the polarization there and people invading the FBI with weapons because they have dared to uphold the rule of law. Or have they? These are the international affairs. And any one of us would see that and our minds would become troubled. And then you think back to Ajahn Brahm with his wonderful talks about how do you calm the mind. And he gave that picture some weeks ago about this lake. It's he calm that lake of the mind. And it's the winds are coming and the storm is there and the waves are high and you want to flatten that lake and you can't pat it flat, but you need that to be flat, to be peaceful. And when you look at this, the state of the world we're in just now, which one of us can be peaceful, and we should be? We can look, again, the political side, that the inflation, having to pay more for our petrol, more for our milk, having to pay more rent, if you can find a place to rent, housing, people who are sleeping on the streets, and you can walk past them and wonder, how do they survive? And then you wonder about the increasing crime, how safe is it? Those who have parked their cars outside, how safe is it right now? Maybe my mind is thinking, I should maybe go and check to see that it hasn't been broken into. And then you can say the politicians are out of touch, and you can get angry at us for not doing what we should be doing, which is what? And these are the national worries which make us so worried. And we can spend time and effort, and our minds can be disturbed by this. Your minds, my mind. Or we can look at the cost of living as a family, the illness, the COVID that we may have had in the family. My son, one of my sons, quite ill for a day, and you wonder, should I take him to hospital or not? Relationships between husband and wife, parents and children. They're never always smooth, are they? The children themselves are having their own problems now. How do you manage with increasing troubles at school, vaping, the bullying going on like that? And then, of course, the careers. What do I want my child to do? How is he going to develop? How is she going to manage? Is it safe for her to go to work? Can she study? So the family has conflict. And then who of us in the family has a peaceful mind? Can we get a peaceful mind? And then lastly, we can look at the individual. We've done international and national and the family. But ultimately, it comes down to the individual sitting there. Why am I here? What's the purpose of my life? Could I do more? What do I want to do? Should I give everything up and become a monk? Should I strive to be prime minister? A lot of us, who of us doesn't feel like that, feel worthless. Who am I? Why am I? I haven't done nearly enough to justify my existence on this earth, and I will beat myself up. We're very good at fighting ourselves, and our minds are always at war with who we are. And so depression and anxiety will come out. And other mental health problems, which make us wonder, will I ever find peace? And yet Ajahn Brahm would tell us about this lake. You can imagine it in your mind's eye, the hills on either side, the trees are there, this great lake out in front of you, and you can imagine that lake, beautifully calm, like a mirror, sitting there. Peaceful, quiet, maybe deep, hiding mysteries, I don't know. But it's a beautiful picture. My mind should be like that before I go into meditation. I can't do that. Yes, you can. How? So we're painting this picture here of what it's like just now. And as a politician, I sit in the chamber, looking around, and certainly getting involved and wondering, now, what is it all about? How can I make a change? What am I doing? Why am I here? Who's listening to me? Well, what can I do about this? Well, there's some answers, outside answers, international, national, family, and the individual answers. I can make laws. The laws very often don't help us. There's a lot of injustice in the world, in us. If you look at what's happening just now, one country is invading another. Are we as a world standing up to that? Who's looking after the children being killed by bombs and bullets? There's laws against that, international laws, but what about power? And you see that all about power internationally. China wants to exert itself. America wants to exert itself. Taiwan's in the middle. Oh dear. But there's laws, international laws about that. There's interest groups trying to smooth this down. The ones, if I invest $1 billion of my dollars, maybe I'll get $2 billion back from that. Maybe I can exert some power there and I get my way and you do what I want. The financial interests. And we sit back looking at these outside answers, not giving the answers that we need. But then nationally, we can look at the same thing. The laws that we make here are very often unjust. For example, if someone is found to be, in my case, growing cannabis, and they found they've got three plants, they could be taken to court and they could lose their home because of a law which says, if we think you're trafficking, we can take your home. We can take everything you possess because you have dared to do something that we have declared as wrong. There was a woman whose husband had left long ago, and she was paying the mortgage, and the husband had done some drug deals. But because the house was still in his name, they wanted to take her house away from her because he had done something bad, although she hadn't seen him for 15 years. And we look at that and we think, how can that be peaceful? So we look at the power here as well, Clive Palmer and Mark McGowan. And you look at that and you think, why? I'm exerting power here. What? How can I get peace just with the laws and the power coming from there? What about the interest groups? Gina Reinhardt, Twiggy Forrest, and the power they exert with the force of their companies, with their money. Is this helping? Is this giving an answer from the outside? Because we want change to happen. Make it happen. Make a law. Spend some money. Make it happen. And still, the charities like the Smith Family Foundation seeking money to help children just live in school and be at peace. Not enough. So those same laws, those same groups, internationally also work nationally. But the same structure from outside also happens in the family. The laws, I am the father of the house, you will do what I say. Well, actually, we all know, I'm the mother of the house, you will do what I say. Is that not so? And the wise man will say, yes, dear. The power of money. If you haven't paid the rent, son, you're not going to go out and do whatever you want to do as a 15-year-old. When you pay rent, you can think about that. The group interests, mother and father or the siblings controlling each other. So it's the same structure from outside. Financial interests. I'll give you some money if you clean your room. You haven't cleaned your room? Nothing. I play those games too. But do they work? Well, to a degree, but do they create peace? And as the individual, how do I, from outside, affect what's happening? Same thing. I could use the laws, say the laws of medicine. I'll take a medication to cure my depression, but it doesn't cure it. I've got pains. I'll take some medication to cure the pains, and I'm still in pain. I can distract myself. I can, say, watch movies all day. I can go and play golf
every day. Not a bad idea, but my golf is terrible. I could withdraw from the world and find myself just leaving everything behind because it's all painful for me. I can't deal with this. I'm going to go into my shell and protect myself so you can't hurt me. And you ask yourself, is that living? And the result is that you might then ultimately withdraw and say, well, I'll choose suicide. I'll empty myself from this world because there's nothing here for me. So these laws from outside, they're problematic. And they all involve the brain. How can I find a solution from outside to fix this? So if the answer doesn't come from outside, where can it come from? Of course, you know, from inside. Not from the brain, but from the mind. Even as a politician or as a doctor, for both persona there, it's the mind which has to work. The solution comes from inside, which is why you're here, because Ajahn Brahm and all the monks there and all the teachings here give us answers. But we know the answers. Settle, go inside, be at peace, meditate. And then, with that insight, handle. So, mind, looking around, what is reality? How real is this life, really? Who am I? Who are you, really? Did you know? There's 8 billion people in this world. If you took all of the empty space out of the atoms of 8 billion people's bodies, just all the empty space, we would fit into the size of a rather large sugar cube. That's a lot of empty space in our bodies. So I look around at some very substantial bodies here, and I'm saying, you're mostly the size of a pinhead? Really? So who are you? Who am I? Really? And if you look at the sugar cube containing 8 billion people's material, where did it come from? Well, it came from inside a star. We're made of stars. So we have a journey to explore. Who am I in this so-called reality, this existence? Why am I? Those are interesting questions, are they not? Can I then learn something about that? I want to take you on the journey that I go on with a scientific mind. I'm absolutely certain Ajahn Brahm is going to scold me for this. Because he is, of course, a physicist as well. He studied pure physics and knows so much more than I ever could begin to know. Let's have a journey inside and see if our minds can find some kind of solution right now for us today. Now, I'm going to have to ask you to use your imagination for this, because I speak from a scientific point of view, and I don't know what you would like to use as an example. And so I'm going to look at remember those atoms in that sugar cube that contains all of the 8 billion people? You can look at those as colored balls. That's a good example. Many different colors. You have to choose your colors. And there's going to be many colors you can actually use. And you're going to have to choose, because I'm a doctor as well as a scientist, a part of the body to follow the path that I take. Because we'll be focusing on that. So you can, in a moment, I'm going to ask you to consider to follow my path. Are you agreeable to that? And we're going to be happy with that. It's going to be a strange journey. And it's not really a meditation, although it can be. It's more of a visualization. It helps me to focus on who I am and why I am. I'll share that journey with you, of course. At one part of that, you can prolong that and make it a deep deep meditation. I'd welcome you to try that, but it's going to be a bit shorter today because I don't want to bore you. So if you're ready and if you're happy for that, you've settled already, you're already relaxed after that wonderful meditation, guided meditation. But just prepare yourselves again, get ready, just relax as Ajahn Brahm has just guided us. Be comfortable. I like to settle myself. I do this in Parliament too, but no one really notices that. And bearing in mind, you can, if you choose, you can imagine, and only imagine, yourself standing however you like, or sitting, or lying down. And as you're in that position, in your mind's eye, you can choose to focus on your breathing. And you'll notice that your breathing is just right and perfect at this moment. And you can look at the breath going in and out and realize this is a wonderful feeling. I wonder how that came about. And as you're getting yourself comfortable, you might find how your body is supported on the chair, on the floor, in a way which is just perfect, and you feel safe and secure. And it might be that you notice your hands resting together folded or on your lap. And as you do that, you might begin to notice the tip of your tongue against your teeth. And now you can realize that your body doesn't really need you just now. Your body is looking after you perfectly, just right. And you can quieten your mind because inside your body, everything is being taken care of. Everything is right, just for you. So in this safe position, you can imagine, and only imagine, a mirror in front of you, wherever you are. And you can look deeply at yourself. And you can choose to focus. And as you focus, come closer to yourself and look. Choose any part of your body that you will, the liver, the heart, the kidney, stomach, a fingernail if you want. I choose the heart. But you can choose what you like. And as you get closer in your mind's eye to that picture of yourself, you can get closer and closer and move towards the skin and focus on the organ that you want to look at. And you go like a microscope into your body and find that organ. And as you find that organ, you can be very comfortable knowing it's working perfectly for you just now. Imagine that organ. Look around it. Feel it. It might be the heart beating gently, calmly. And you can get closer to that in your microscopic mind. And look at the edge of that organ and see there's a start. And you can get closer and closer. And you might, if you imagine hard, be able to see, like a magnifying glass or a microscope, an individual cell emerging from that organ. Peer at that cell and see the cell wall. You might imagine it like a square room of a house. And as you get closer to that wall, you can begin to see, as you get closer and closer, you can begin to see the molecules. And this is strange, isn't it? We can now see those molecules, and you can get closer and see an individual atom in that cell. Imagine, if you will, a carbon atom. 6 protons, 6 neutrons. Give each of those a color. One color for protons, one color for neutrons. And choose the colors which really feel good. and observe those for a moment. And as you do that, you know that in a moment, but not yet, you're going to get closer to one of those protons or neutrons, one of those colors. And as you do that, you know when you get close enough, you're going to break that ball. And as you get closer and closer, you know that when you break that, other balls are going to appear. And do that now. And as you do that, those balls suddenly come forth. And each one of those has got a different color. These are the subatomic particles, muons, gluons, quarks, bosons. And amazing, see those colors get closer and closer to one of those subatomic particles. Get closer. And in a moment, but not yet, you're going to find one of those. And as you get closer, you're going to break that apart. And you know that other little particles will come from that. And they also will have their colors, and you can choose to go there now and break that. And particles appear with beautiful colors, like a breaking apart and smashing all these colors coming apart. And as you get closer, you can choose one of those different colors and go deeper and deeper and choose one of those. And as you get closer, you know you're going to break that apart. And getting closer, and it breaks apart. And what do you find? There is a ball there. Get closer, choose that color. And as you look at that, you realize it's not actually a solid ball. It's actually a wave. And you realize that the foundation of all existence is a wave. Give that wave a color and examine that wave and feel that wave. And as you feel that wave, you realize that you are in absolute nothingness. It is you and that wave. Appreciate that. As you are there floating in absolute nothingness, with a wave, with a feeling. And you can, if you choose, feel what that wave does. And you might recognize that wave, that pure energy, as love. And as you sit or lie or stand and feel that energy of love, the foundation of all existence. And you begin to realize that this is just beautiful. Take a moment now to enjoy floating in absolute nothingness with a wave of love. And as you enjoy that, you could, if you wish, choose to stay here for as long as you wish to meditate. But we can begin to bring you back a little bit and see all of the other waves, all of the other particles with their beautiful colors, the myriad of colors which, when they come together, form a beautiful light. And you can begin to pull back and put that light together and find a shining white ball and withdraw a little more
and see the other balls come together as shining light. And come back a little bit more and join them again. That first proton you saw is now a shining light. And come back a little bit more and see that shining light is now a molecule, beautiful, even more vivid and brilliant. And pull back a little bit more and see that cell wall shining with the light of love. And come back a little bit more and find you have the organ shining beautifully with your true reality. And come back a little bit more and find yourself as a shining body, glowing, emanating, radiating love, floating in nothingness, shining, beautiful light. And here you could sit or stand and lie and just enjoy the meditation. But you might choose to come back a little bit more and other beings come into place. The people beside you, in front of you or behind you are now there, and they also are shining with beautiful light in their true reality. And you can know that the foundation of their existence, like yours, is love. And as you come back and they become clearer and clearer, you can feel that we are all united in love. Beautiful, different, but the same. And you can focus again on your breathing now and realize that no matter where you are, who you are, your reality is different to what you have previously thought. The light and the love that is you and everyone around. And with that in mind, you can now begin, if you choose, to open your eyes and breathe and be thankful for having understood who you really are, who I really am. Now, can you imagine now how a Buddhist politician might feel in the chamber of people who are shouting at each other? And can you feel perhaps that this might be a good way of dealing with all that troubles the mind? That this reality that we think we know is not real. There's another reality behind that, who we really are. And I would welcome you to share that with me in times of trouble. Go deep into your body. Appreciate who you really are. And share that with people who do not yet know.
Thank you so much, Dr. Walker. That was amazing. Your voice is very calming and soothing. It's almost like bedtime with Dr. Walker. It was amazing for me because I am a scientist. And so when you were describing light just coming from a cell, what I envisioned in my head was fluorescent staining of cells. So it's just bright green, bright red. And that's what I see in my day-to-day life. But just what you've shared, just from, I guess, calming the mind when things can be chaotic, to just bring it down to who are we? Who am I? Who are you? Who are we collectively? And what is our purpose here together?
just sharing space and being here, and then taking that to, I guess, the world, other conflicts in the world, and putting things into perspective. I think that's just a really well-rounded vision of just reflecting on I feel really grateful for the things I have. So I thank you so much for coming down and giving a presentation tonight.
It is very challenging though, isn't it? Not that many people really follow the science. If we're looking at the James Webb Telescope, for example, we're peering into billions of years ago. We're looking here at a universe which is so vast we cannot comprehend it. And yet the science tells us that one atom here can be in immediate contact with an atom at the other end of the universe instantaneously. How is that possible? But this is what the science tells us. So our petty problems we have here, are they really important? Well, actually, yes, they are. We're in a three-dimensional reality right now, although we're actually fourth-dimensional creatures. And we have a job to do here, which if we don't have the right perspective, we're not able to do as well as we might. For those who would be angry with us, responding with love, even if they show hate back to us, that's their problem. My heart feels at peace. Nothing more irritating for people than to actually have someone treat them with love. And you just walk away and let them find their own path. What I find is that when we do this, people begin to ask questions. Tell me, for example, a short while ago, I had a tragedy in my personal life. One of my sons killed himself. And it was devastating. So people, we buried him on Friday, and on the Tuesday I gave a talk in Parliament about that, what it meant. One of the hardest things I've ever done, by the way. But people ask, how are you coping with that? And so I talk about what it means that the body in the grave isn't actually there, that the energy that was him is still there. Because that light I told you about just now, that is the basis of every single cell, every single atom, that light is traveling at the speed of light. When you think about that, we don't really exist except as a temporary 3D coalition. The energies that we are carries on. So my son is not in that grave. His body is. He is with me now. And he experiences love now and knows my love. And I know his love reaches me too. So when you see that, then the tragedy of loss, although it still brings tears to my eyes, are tears of love, not tears of grief.
Thank you. That's beautiful to share. I would like to open the floor for questions.
Thank you, Dr. Walkers, for coming to Buddhist Society tonight. I'm so proud that, we have politicians like you, we have a bit of, all who knows about Buddhism. And the next one is we hope Sam Lim will be giving a talk to in this hall in a few weeks' time, we hope, if we are able to do that. And thank you for sharing your personal life story. It's very important, and we felt that because we knew each other. Thank you so much.
I'm so looking forward to seeing Sam Lim here. The one time I've met him was actually at lunch at your house, and I really want to do that again because I knew then he was going to win, and I know he's going to do a good job.
Bill's got a mic.
Thank you, that's better. I'd like to share the the power of the mind and the heart and prayer and meditation. I went away for a weekend, and I went away with a bad back and a sore hip, and it was a weekend of a lot of sitting, and I thought, will I be able to cope with all the sitting? And I did. And I came back, no backache, no hip ache. I feel rejuvenated. And so it's just so wonderful when, you know, I cared for myself. I loved myself through the meditation and gave thanks and joined with some beautiful people. We chanted a lot, we meditated a lot, we shared a lot. It was a lot of love, and the healing was just amazing. So a week later, I'm still no backache, no hip ache, and worked in the garden, and yeah, it's just the power of the mind and the heart are just wonderful. And thank you for your sharing. I also lost a son, and I had some through the Buddhist people supporting me, I felt really, really loved and close to my son, and I do all the time. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. You mentioned Anita Murjani. I was actually meeting with her in university in America, Charlottesville, and they were investigating near-death experiences. Now, Anita wasn't near death; she was actually dead. Undoubtedly, she was dead. I said goodbye to her on the way to hospital. I knew I'd never see her again alive, but it was not physically possible. Terminal cancer, terminal organ failure, multi-organ system failure. You do not survive that, either one of those. But this was about 2,500 near-death experiences, and the people who investigate these are certain that the mind is not part of the body. This is stunning, because people think the mind's in the brain. It's not. The mind exists when the brain is dead, and it's experiencing things. And Anita's story, I do encourage you to read that, was fascinating. So that taught me, that actually brought me up short, and the interview it says that, that it caused me to actually fundamentally redefine what I believe. Up until then, it was theory. You know, this is a nice theory about the energy and all that, but actually that was real. And it made me reconsider everything I know. What is real? Because what happened to her was physically impossible. Just there's no way that happens. Now, the world outside, what did the world do with that? Well, actually, they buried her medical notes. They were lost. They wanted to see what actually happened. So a year later, a researcher comes to examine that. Her notes have mysteriously vanished. They're gone. The doctor, who was stunned and said, yes, this is unusual, I will support this, I will investigate this, turned himself around and said, no, it's perfectly normal, this happens, and refused to accept that the impossible was possible. Because the very foundation of what they believed in, this three-dimensional reality, had been challenged, and they couldn't stand up to the challenge. And this is normal. This is what people do. So when we actually have a firm belief in something which is proven beyond doubt, most of the world is going to say, this is nonsense. Now, the mind can certainly control so many things. With the power of the placebo, we can actually make people healed just by taking sugar water. Joe Dispenza would talk about that. We can do that ourselves just by determining, this is what I will do. This is my purpose. I will do this. And we haven't, because we're three-dimensional reality and it's so very, very firm. For example, this idea about 8 billion people into a sugar cube. If I were to hit your head onto the table, it would still hurt. It's a very solid head and a very solid table. So this reality is real. But it's not, in another sense, it's not real. So the mind, I think, is a key to unraveling, to moving us into a better place, a better understanding for our existence just now, before we move on to maybe the next life, maybe another existence, maybe Arahant, who knows? But what we're experiencing just now is basically a learning, I think, a learning phase that we move on. And I've seen this time and time again as a doctor. As a politician, I haven't seen that.
So so given that understanding that we're not the body and we're not the mind, when you sit with someone who is dying, in quotes, what's the best advice you can give? Because I always remember reading a book, and I can't remember what it was called, but it was about a lady who had locked-in syndrome. So she was non-compos mentis. She couldn't communicate. She couldn't move. But the mind was still active. And she eventually came out of that state, and she said the scariest thing to her was people coming into the hospital room and offering sympathy or talking like about her as though she was already gone, and that's what scared her the most. So what advice do you give to people who are sitting with someone in that state or sitting with someone who is dying? Like, how can we sit with love and kindness? Maybe I've answered my own question. What advice do you give as a Buddhist GP?
I remember many years ago in Germany as a GP, a man was dying of liver cancer. And in Germany, you're not allowed to tell the patient they're dying. The patients know, but they're not allowed to hear that because it could be more than I could bear. That's just a cultural thing there. So a year later, he was dying, and his wife had refused steadfastly to accept this. No, he's going to, we can do a liver transplant. And the end was near, and so I had to do this. I sat her down and taught her how to hold her husband's hand and tell him how much she loved him, as he wasn't unconscious, but those last two precious weeks to tell him all the things she hadn't said in the past year, how much of the importance, how much you mean to me, how much I love you. I hear stories from the people who have got locked-in syndrome, that good music there, their favorite music, repeating how much you mean to them as if you are still alive and you will come back. But if it is right for you to go, I give you permission. Okay? The example there is if I keep you alive, even though you're not alive, because I love you so much. It's not actually love, it's selfishness. But I would love you to be here, but if you choose to go, that's fine, but I love you so much. Here are your children, and this is what they did in school, and this is fine, and so we'll pass those messages on. That's for the people who are in long-term coma. But we lose power. I can't imagine many people would be able to do that week after week, month after month, because you just get on with your life. So I've got no good answer for that. But telling people how much you love them, one of the last words I want to say when I leave this world is of how much I love my wife and family. So that goes on, and I get that back. And this will be ongoing, eternal.
Good evening. I couldn't stop myself from sharing my own experience, maybe with an aim to answer maybe your question and also seek a little bit of validation from the honorable speaker. Yeah, I am a nurse and I work in a residential aged care facility. And I am a born Buddhist, but yes, I am open to any faith. So not just sticking on to Buddhism and then trying to push it down other people's throat. So not like that. I'm open. So there is this very senior resident lady. She was always very agitated and most of the time angry. And I did a history check on her. And then she was a nurse before in her life. And she was a very successful nurse, a very ambitious, a very capable. And one time she was running, managing the whole of one surgical unit in a big metropolitan hospital here. So in that sense, she was very successful and she was very capable as well. So that means she was equally having a lot of stress, work-related stress in her life. So maybe that contributed to her, or that's just my assumption. So during the end of life phase of her, at the stage of end of her life, she was put on palliative care, of course, by the physician. And I happened to be on a shift one afternoon, and one of the carers comes and comes to ask some help for getting her on the recliner chair. So I go there and I talk to her, and maybe the way I approached her, she liked it. So she listened, and then she agreed to sit on the chair, recliner chair. That was about 2 months before she went into a severe decline and then on put on palliative care. So that time, and then we put her on the chair, and as I was on my knees down and she was on the chair, and I was trying to put on her pant when she grabbed hold of my hair, and then like she pulled so hard, and I thought the whole handful of hair was going to go, and it was so painful. And I let go of me, it's hurting me, I shouted. I told her, and then the care staff helped by releasing each finger of her hand off my hair, and suddenly she, like as if in a state of realization, she just let go of my hair. And then I looked at her, why did you do that to me? It really hurt. I was just trying to help you. And then she just gave me a smile. And then she wouldn't say anything. And then we groomed her, and then I left. Then after 2 months or so, I happened to go on a leave, and then I joined, and after 2 months, weirdly, I picked up that shift that afternoon. And when I went there, it was a morning shift, and I found she was on in the last stage of her. She passed away the next day, so that the day before she passed away, on that morning, I picked up that shift weirdly, and then I went to her, and I also am very interested in palliative care nursing. So I went to her, and then I don't know, I'm not trying to say something say something against anybody or any organization. But here I feel that once a resident is put on palliative care, there is as if like an invisible sign, okay, now it's time for her to leave, so let's not do anything, let her die peacefully, kind of a sign put on the door. So people hardly go there unless there is a severe need. So yes, I went there, and then I found that she needed some very good care of the oral hygiene. And when I did the sobs, she was really sucking on the sob, and then she was even swallowing, but she can't speak. She's like deeply sedated. And that moment, after doing all those, I held her hand,
And I told her, I don't know why I picked this shift, but I think now I know. And I just want to tell you that I've forgiven you for that day for pulling on my hair. And that thing, like, it's still, I still get goosebumps. She squeezed my hand, and her breathing pattern changed. She was breathing heavy. And then I told she hears me. I thought I knew she heard me, and I told her, you always know that you've been a very great nurse. You've touched and healed so many people who are in need, in the most of their needs, that many people. And you are a very loving mother, a good friend, and all those love words like the speaker was saying, I acknowledged her, all those. And then her breathing, like she started breathing more and more. Then I left. And when I was about to leave my shift, I saw her son. And I also heard from the other colleagues and staff that the son and the mom also did not have a very good relationship towards the end, because mom was getting very irritable. And then the son was like, why, you know, when he comes and visits her, she shows and she even throws the table, pushes like that. So that day the son was near her, because now he also knew it's time for him to be there. But then I wondered, he must be having so much of undone things, unsaid things with his mom, and mom also must have had all those. So I just knocked on the door, and may I come in? My shift is over, but I have a bit of a thought that I would like to share with you. Would you mind? And he said, no, no, come on, come in, he said. And I told him, at this time, when somebody is about to exit, it's the right time, they hear you. If you can hold your mom's hand and tell her, thank you, mom, for letting me come through you. And thank you for being the best mom. Thank you for caring for me. Thank you for all the love that you've given me. And also tell her that I'll always love you. You will always live in me. And I'm so proud to be your son. So just say those words, sir, I told him. And then he said, will she really hear? Let's try it, sir. And then he held her hand, and he did it. And she squeezed his hand, and her breathing changed. And then that, I think, made a big impact on his life. And then she is going with less weight. Her energy will go with less weight. And with less weight, she might transcend to a higher rebirth. In Buddhism, we have like that. So we'll get a... Or if she's going up to heaven, her journey will be quicker, because most of the weight she had were all shed off in that few moments. And then the son will have no guilt now. His grief and his bereavement period will be shortened as well. So that's what I thought. And then that evening, then I came home and I just put on my headphones, and then I danced to the songs I love outside. And then my children were asking me, why you are acting so weird today? No, it's just a bit farewell to a resident that I cared and whom I was connected. And I thought this is a nice way to... And yeah, I just danced. Instead of praying, I just danced. So this is how some of the things we can do to the departing one, to the loved ones and anyone. So, yeah, sorry for taking so long.
Thank you for sharing.
I think those of us working in the field could share story after story about this. Death is not what we think it is. I'll tell you a story from my life. I was 17 years old. I was traveling from Scotland to Germany and having a wonderful time. It was beautiful. But suddenly, outside the Autobahn, outside Aachen on the Autobahn, my world collapsed. It was as if the black clouds were above my head, as if the rain was pouring down, the tears flowed down my cheek. I was on my way to Olympic Games. What more could I want? I was going to see my good friends in Munich. So I traveled down to a pen pal in Switzerland, and I got a telegram there. It turns out that that moment there was the exact moment my father died. And it's something I've never actually forgotten. There's an impact there, just sudden, an energy there. It is all about energy, really, I think, the energy of life, the placebo effect, the mind, what you've described there about death, is passing on. We are not who we think we are. Just as I was saying here at the very end of that coming out of the that visualization, I don't know about you, but for me, that lake was calm. That is the power of having been engaged in this, that despite all the tempest, we can make a change. That lake becomes calm and all is well.
Thank you, Doctor, for the meditation this evening. I have a question relating to that and your medical perspective and what you've just been saying about reality. And during the meditation, I was drawn to really focus on my bowels, where I have chronic inflammation and a disease. And I was wondering how what you're saying informs perspective on disease. And when you were talking about things functioning well, I felt a softening, because I feel like I have a lot of resistance and judgment, that there's a part of my body that's not working the way it's supposed to, and I don't want to feel it, and I'm afraid it's going to get worse. And during the meditation, I felt a permission to, go, wow, it actually works pretty well. I just wondered if you had any comments about, that in relation to the meditation and the other topics.
Ooh, how many hours do you have?
I'll stay. Depends how much time you've got.
Look, there's... One of the things that I like to impress is not just there's not one way, there's a wide variety of approaches. I've mentioned before we're three-dimensional creatures, we're maybe fourth-dimensional existence, which means that we can take out of the three dimensions and we can take out of the fourth dimension. Anything which heals is going to be good. And the placebo effect, the mind effect, the power, the Joe Dispenza approach is absolutely valid. It doesn't mean to say we can't use that nature, what nature is there. For example, not that I'm focused purely on cannabis, but for example, cannabis water, which is just extracted from the hemp plant, is actually a wonderful medium for fixing irritable bowel syndrome. Much better than all the medication I could think of that we'd normally give. So the artificial stuff, fine, we can do that. I've given that. I've given lots and lots of the normal medication. But nature works very nicely. For example, there's a lovely medicine, what's the English for it? It's a milk thistle, Mariendistel in German. And it's really great for helping the liver. Now, no one believed that, really, until this man said, okay, fine, I'm going to take a plate of deadly mushrooms. These, in German, it's Knollenblätterpilz. And it kills the liver by periportal necrosis. So he cooked up a plate of these deadly mushrooms, had a large amount of the milk thistle, tasted lovely, and his liver was fine. And I've used that milk thistle to give to people, say, with liver cancer, much better results there. They're still going to die of the liver cancer, but the function is much better. It's nature. It's what I can kill you with nature, I can heal you with nature. So we need to actually live in accord with our three-dimensional reality. But I find that the synthetics... Number four cause of death in America, and probably in Australia too, is properly prescribed medications which have been properly administered. Okay? And again, going back to the cannabis, I can tell you that the number of deaths due to cannabis are not quite as many as the numbers who have been killed by unicorns. It's zero.
But as a natural plant. But the stuff that we can artificially, the opium, which is actually is quite deadly, regularly kills people every day in both our countries. So we have to be very, very careful about focusing on just one area. Taking a broad view, I think, is far better. But nature is better, okay? And the fourth dimension is also, the mind is also better. But then you get the opposite happening. Look what's happening in America just now with the fundamentalists who've got a very particular mindset, which is very unhealthy, and people are dying. So we can use it in two directions.
Hello, thank you for your talk, and really inspiring. I'm curious to know about the therapeutic effect of cannabis for combating or healing anxiety and depression, and if there is any worrisome or things that we have to be aware of when using cannabis as well.
Well, the first thing to be aware of is that cannabis is a lovely example of where the mind can go wrong. We've had 80-odd years of propaganda, and in China, for example, cannabis is deeply hated. I mean, I speak to Chinese people as a politician. They think, oh, cannabis, we can't have you. Labour or liberal, we'll talk about that, but cannabis, nuh-uh. So realizing that it's actually a very big topic, but they're approaching it from a point of view which isn't factual. It's the belief system, which has been taught over generations to people. So they have to bear that in mind. That could be a negative. You take this, oh, I'm going to die, or it's going to cause schizophrenia. It's not. Cannabis itself addresses the endocannabinoid system. I'm going to get scientific just now. We have a number of systems in the body, and we've recently discovered a system within every organ of our bodies, mostly in the brain, but widespread throughout the body, which is designed to receive cannabinoid products. We make our own cannabis. There's a molecule called ananda, which is one of several molecules which are actually part of that system. So taking cannabis, actually, and we're talking here just medicinal, not getting high, but taking medicinal cannabis is a great way of engaging with the endocannabinoid system. I've used it successfully for treating autism, Alzheimer's disease, this kind of stuff. For anxiety, it's very, very useful. Now, what I was saying earlier about how to manage things, the things from outside, the things from inside, you can use cannabis on the outside to help quieten the mind very successfully without any adverse effects. It's not addictive, it's not dangerous. To quieten the mind, to allow you to then get your own mind working better. So rather than these rough waves out there and you can't quiet them down, because the more you try, the rougher it gets. The cannabis itself can help you quieten that mind to the stage where you can then begin to engage your own mind and then get a proper peace. It's wonderful. But it shouldn't be a substitute for working from the inside. So it's very, very useful for managing anxiety. Looked at from the point of view of danger, say benzodiazepines, your Valiums, your antidepressants, far, far safer. Does it always work? No, not really, but most times it does. So it's a very useful system there, but there's plenty of other choices you can use, but cannabis is probably the safest and the simplest.
Disease. Would cannabis help Lyme's disease? She's been sick for 7 years and it's gone into her brain, it's gone into her eyes. There's cysts in the brain stem. Yeah, it's very serious.
Well, it's useful for managing symptoms and nausea, pains, anxiety. This is kind of thing. Very useful for that, for Lyme's disease. The chronic pain would be very useful for that. As treating the actual cause, it wouldn't do much good for that. You need to do other things, but the natural medicine in Germany is very advanced, and looking here, I'd say taking the whole body blood and using that, cleaning it, and putting it back in, like a renal dialysis, might be one way of doing that. But it's a very complex procedure, and sadly in Australia, we're not allowed to do that because Lyme doesn't technically exist.
Yeah. So basically, only if you go to Germany to have the treatment.
Or America. America's got Lyme disease treatment facilities too, but Germany I know.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, let's all thank Dr. Brian Walker for coming down and sharing your knowledge and your beautiful guided meditation. In the word of Ajahn Brahm, we would like to finish the night with three sadhus. If you'd like to join me.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
And we'll lastly pay homage to the Buddha, so with the triple gem. So if you know the chanting, please join me. Otherwise, I've got the book here. Maybe Dr. Walker would like to join me as well. Araham Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddham Bhagavatam Abhivadami Svahato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhanam Nanasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanganam Nanami.
Have a wonderful night, everyone.